Okay. I have a solution. Wait, no, I remembered. I wanted to talk about one.
Okay.
Can we do,
Good, because we're here to do that. That's what we're here for.
We got to do that. Okay. Hey, everyone. My name's Adam Brouse.
I'm Scott Maupin.
And we are Solutions from the Multiverse. Also, Solutions FM, if you're so inclined. You know, you
could be we'll answer to either name.
An abbreviation. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And every week, we share a unheard of new solution. It also has to be kind of plausible. It's not just like, ooh, totally insane. It has some plausibility. I mean, we could say, oh, I have a solution for this. Rub ketchup on it. I mean, that wouldn't be right, right? So it's some kind of plausibility, but the idea is that it's totally new.
What if the problem is my fries are too dry? Then that's the perfect solution.
There you go. There you go. You're right. But it's not exactly, but it's not a new solution, so it'd never be on this podcast. You'd have to say like, rub I don't know duck you know cod liver oil on it or something. No one's ever done that probably. I hope. Cod liver oil, throw that on some dry french fries, you get some pretty oily gross french fries.
Sounds like a great solution.
Totally great. Okay. No. I've got a solution that's not food related.
Okay,
should I go for it?
Please. What do you got for us, Adam?
Oh, wait, I can't. That's a bad... I was talking about it with my friend, and then he was like, don't call it that. And I was like, okay, call it something else.
Oh, no.
So,
we're going to get the revised name.
We're going to use the revised name because I don't think... I get canceled for the real name.
Now I got to know.
not because I'm bad, but because it sounds bad.
Okay. Hey. Okay, say the real name, and I'll beep it out.
No, we'll do it.
And then you can say the revised name.
Really?
I'm just curious now. I can't think of anything else.
Okay. I'll tell you what it is, and then later I'll tell you what the name is. And you can bleep it out.
Okay. I
will. So basically, what I'm saying is we should make anti-coup militias.
Anti-coup militias.
Yeah. Right. So. Okay. So
is that not just the armed forces?
No, actually, armed forces are often involved in coups.
That's true. Military coups.
Yeah. They can be. I mean, usually that's one of the deciding factors, is if the dictatorial person can get the military to sort of side with them. And it's usually not very hard because they're like, look, if you don't like go with me, there's going to be chaos, and the militaries hate chaos, right? So they kind of like lock down. So they can usually do it. If they can, that's the risk. So the only real last line of defense is the people to reject the coup.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to have like right now, do you know of any standing, right? Okay. Like if you go into a school, you're in any classroom, there's like always the thing on the wall. It says in case of fire, here's how to escape the room. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. But we're in a democracy. And last time I checked, I've never seen like, here's how to like, if there's a coup, pull this tab, you know, there's nothing.
Right. Yeah. So we need like an airplane brochure that tells us how to deal with it in case of a coup.
We should make flight. It should look just like it. Dude, that would... Okay, solutions merch. We got to start a merch store. I learned that a bunch of successful YouTubes and podcast shows, they make most of their money from their merch store. So we should make this merch. We should make like a laminate thing that's like what to do in case of coup. And it's like, that's so cool. Yeah.
It's got like those little like stick figure drawings of the people doing the,
and they're all smiling,
different safety procedures.
They're smiling with their heads between their legs as their plane dives into the ocean. The rest of us are all like screaming and grabbing our loved ones' hands like, that's what how people actually behave.
Okay. So these would be just random regular people who are also like secretly or not secretly members of
publicly. Cause you want to
anti-coup militia.
Yeah. Cause you want to threaten the potential coup people should be like scared of doing a coup because they should know that there's going to be this like swift and deliberate reaction by the people that's like decentralized but like very forceful, and that would deter a coup more because they would know that the coups
yeah, that's right, no, that's correct,
coups is that coups? What it is? Yeah, the coups, yeah. They would be like, oh shoot, we should be careful about doing this coup because we'll get in trouble. So no, it should be public. And well, let me put it this way: the Second Amendment is considered to be the right to bear arms, is it not?
Yes,
but I would say that the Second Amendment is actually the right to form a militia.
Right. Yeah, that's how it's phrased.
It says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So I would say that it's almost like the founding fathers are telling us what really matters for freedom is militia. And I agree with that. But I would add to that the research, to have a coup response. Now, people maybe listening are like, oh, we should get armed to the teeth for our coup response. But actually, it turns out that a nonviolent coup response would probably be the best one in America to do.
Well, that's exactly where I was going to go first. It's like, how do you expect normal citizenry to deal with the firepower of the, like, in the event that the military decides to do a coup? They've got all the guns and the best and biggest and knowledge of how to use them. So,
right.
And so what is a non-violent coup? What does that look like? I can't even imagine.
Well, the coup might be violent, but I'm talking about the anti-coup militias.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. What is non-violent anti-coup militia? Yeah,
the anti-coup militias. So, I let me tell you a story. Okay. So, in college, I was in a club that no one else wanted to be a part of. It was kind of like that.
It was called the Adam Club.
Exactly.
I was the president, and surprisingly, nobody wanted to join.
It was sort of like I wouldn't want to be a part member of a club that accepted me as a member. It was like,
I went to the student union. I said, hey, everybody, want to join the Adam Club? And nobody said yes.
It was weird. So I literally started a club, and it was all about in learning about nonviolence, nonviolent action, using peaceful means to manipulate power, essentially.
Did someone walk by and heckle you, and they're like, you can't be violent if there's no one else there to get into a fight with?
Yeah, you're by yourself, dude.
When you're sitting by yourself, you're fine.
You're all by yourself. You're totally
pretty
fine.
Nonviolent, there's bro.
No fight coming your way. Exactly. Thank you for making me relive the trauma of my loneliness. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I wasn't lonely. Yeah,
it was very like a deep emotional trauma. No, I was actually had a lot of fun in college. I had a lot of good friends. But in this one case, I was just like off in no man's land and no one else was interested. But I was very interested and I learned everything about nonviolence, like way too much. I read like every word Gandhi put to paper. I read not like Nelson Mandela's like 1,000-page self autobiography, which by the way, everyone, like when he gets to Robben Island in prison, you can just skip until he leaves because he didn't know what was happening. So that there's about 400 pages in this 1,000-page book where he's just like, and then I heard some news, but I couldn't confirm what had happened. And so we kept moving the rocks, in the prison. I was like, oh my God, who let him put all 400 pages of this in the thing? This would be like a cool 600-page book.
He's like, yeah, there must have been a new cook at the galley because suddenly the food was markedly improved.
Exactly. And then it's like, they gave me a new pair of pants. And it's like, Jesus, Mandiba, just come on, cut to the chase here. Anyways, really good book, The long Walk to Freedom. But so I read all these things and I found, because this was like not pre-internet and not pre-Google, but I was Googling and I was using the library resources really heavily to find the right stuff. Mm-hmm. And I found this guy named Gene Sharp. And this guy, Gene Sharp, who was alive, he had this thing called the Albert Einstein Institute in Boston. And I was like a complete devotee of this guy. And I read all his books and I like learned all about the Einstein Institute because Albert Einstein was famously like a pacifist or not necessarily a pacifist, but yeah, he was anti-war and, especially after he helped create the atomic bomb.
I was going to say he should not have done that part probably.
Well, maybe not. Some, you might say atomic bombs have secured almost war, world peace for the last 100 years. So
you might say they've killed hundreds of thousands of people.
Well, they killed 100,000 people, but yeah. But anyways, there hasn't been a major war between two major powers since they were invented. So that's pretty cool. But
very
cool. It is super cool. Terrifying, but cool. But yeah, complicated issue, obviously. But I just want to, I feel like that's not given enough credence sometimes. But the thing is this Albert Einstein Institute and Gene Sharp was so cool. I went to New York to visit my aunt and to kind of hang out in New York for just like a week, maybe like a spring break or something, or like in the summer for a week. And I was like, this Albert Einstein Institute is in Boston. So I get on the Chinatown bus because I had no money. I get on the Chinatown bus in New York, in Chinatown, and it takes you to Chinatown, Boston. Have you ever ridden this bus?
I've not been to New York or Boston. No.
There are chickens on the bus. at least, I mean, it's literally like, it's like
China people who are afraid to fight you.
They're just
like challenge them.
Lily livered, yellow bellied.
What?
Lily livered. But good thing I was
going to Boston. What's up?
I was using nonviolence to fight them. So
that's right.
They were just crushed under my
emotion. You were just calling them chickens.
Yeah.
They're like, I will fight you. And you're like, no, you won't. I'm nonviolent, you chicken.
Boom. And they just punched me right in the face.
Okay, so this got chickens on a bus.
Yeah, I mean, it was like Chinatown. It was like a really cool bus. It was $10 to go from New York to Boston, Chinatown to Chinatown.
Okay,
I get off the bus in Boston. I have only one reason to be in Boston, and that's
Celtics
to go meet Gene Sharp. This guy doesn't know that I'm coming. I just go to his office in the middle of the day and I knock on the door. It's just this like totally like modest. Like this is one room office that he holds that says Albert Einstein Institute on, you know, the little card. And I'm like, and with my backpack and like my socks pulled all the way up. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to meet, you know, Gene Sharp. I knock on the door and I'm like, oh, my name's Adam. And I go to college and I
bring like, all your books. Sir, I brought my entire club with me.
Yeah. And here's my whole club.
we've arrived on your doorstep together right now.
Yeah. And he's like, oh, he's this old guy. And he's like, oh, welcome. Yes. Come in, you know, can I offer you some tepid water? You know, he's just this like old man who's like nice and friendly. And he's just, you know, they say like never meet your heroes, you know, and he was good. You know, he's a cool guy. But I mean, he was just like doing his day. And like, I was just there all of a sudden and he hadn't like prepared anything or anything. So he was just like, oh yeah. Well, what are you studying? Oh yeah. Oh. And then I was like, I tried to like ask him like a profound question to see if I could like get like some profound answer. And he just was like, well, it's all in this book, you know. And then I'd ask another question and he'd be like, well, it's all. And he'd kind of look through and be like, it's all in this book. You know, he'd written like 16 books. So like every question I had, he just was like, read this another book, you know.
You basically showed up on his door, knock knock, and you were like, hey, could you smart for me, please? Could you
smart for me please?
Yeah.
It was still a very meaningful thing because I met, you know, even to this day, I mean, I think he's still alive, but even to this day, he is the greatest. I mean, he has been for his time the greatest sort of bearer of the flame of this theory of nonviolence. The most recent though, that torch was passed though recently to a woman named Erica Chenoweth, who is a Harvard researcher right there in Boston. Probably knew Gene.
It was passed peacefully. So now, like a tournament.
It was a pretty bloody
best of the best tournament where they had a fight for who gets the title of most nonviolent.
It wasn't violent. There wasn't even coordination. Erica was just like Erica Chenoweth. Actually, she's really cool. When she talks about it, she was like, well, I didn't think that any of this could possibly be true. You know, she was like a PhD in political philosophy and international studies and stuff. And she was like, well, this couldn't possibly be true that like nonviolence did anything. Like, of course, violence is the main arbiter, or like the final arbiter of power in society. And then she like actually did like a data analysis. This is kind of what she's known for. She and her co-researcher pulled all the conflicts like in the last, whatever, 300 years and categorized them. And filtered them and categorized them into violent or nonviolent. And obviously they're a mixture, but they had these kind of rigorous standards for whether it was a violent or nonviolent. And then they found out that actually nonviolent methods for 300 years, like since before modernity, have actually been more successful in achieving whatever the goals were than violent conflicts. And that's for a bunch of reasons. Violent conflicts are dangerous. They're kind of unpredictable, you know, they kind of swirl out of control and stuff. Whereas nonviolent conflicts, you have like discipline because you kind of, you know, and people stay kind of calm because no one's like burning shit down and like killing people and stuff.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. But anyways, really interesting. Erica Chenoweth and Gene Sharp. So Gene Sharp wrote this book that's actually an open source book that I urge everyone to go and look. And it's called Anti-Coup.
Anti-Coup.
The Anti-Coup.
Okay.
And it's a free and open source book, but you can also buy it, which, you know, you should buy it. Give Gene a little money. It's like $12. But you can also I think you can just download it too, because it's meant to be like a public good, you know. It's meant to be like this thing that kind of isn't, it's like vaccination, like the way we just vaccinated everyone for the pandemic. This book and the idea of like inculcating this idea of like an anti-coup is like a vaccine for a country against coups. Now, when I met Gene Sharp, I did not think that we would live through a coup during my lifetime, right, in America. I thought. But then January 6th happened, like, last, you know, 2 years ago, and I was like, oh, well, immediately now everyone's going to start reading this book, right? People are going to start preparing for the next possible coup, right? Because we almost had one, right? Mm-hmm. And then I just kept waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. And now it's been 2 years and I've never even heard anyone breathe a word of it.
No, it's insane. What you see is, like, people pass around that, the picture from the Holocaust Museum that's like the signs of fascism or, you know, like, mm-hmm. these types of memes. But I don't see anything coup specific. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the way you move from, like, democracy to fascism, or from, you know, democracy to, you know, explicit, you know, oligarchy or democracy to whatever, is through a coup. That's how it happens. So if we really cared about, especially the Second Amendment, like, I can almost get on board with the people who care about the Second Amendment when they say, you know, we have to be ready for anything to, like, protect ourselves from the government, to defend freedom. I agree completely. I look at Erica Chenoweth's research that actually has figured out which would be the most successful way for us to actually do that. And it turns out it's not guns. It's actually being prepared to execute this, like, nonviolent mass action against the government and against, you know, okay, anyone who would try to do a coup.
So for people who haven't read that or looked into it, what does that look like? Can you describe what that would look like instead of a bunch of people grabbing guns and then using force?
Exactly. Yeah. So basically what you do is, well, this is why you need to, like, prepare, because you can't do it spontaneously. That's why there should be these, like, you got to bleep it out here, but I'll tell you what it was going to be called. It was going to be called but then I realized it sounded like the
it shares similarities to something you don't want to evoke. Evoke in
and
the
I
mind
didn't
of
realize
listener,
at yeah. all. I didn't realize at all when I started saying it. But yeah, so what we want is anti-coup militias. That's really what they are. They're militias, not armed militias. These are nonviolent militias, but they're people who meet up and are members of, like, a club locally, right? It would be like a local sort of activist club. Mm-hmm. Where you don't have to meet all the time. I mean, you could just meet once and have, like, a website that trains you, and then maybe meet a few times to know your other kind of anti-coup militia members. You might do trainings, you know, once a year. You might do a training.
You go out to the wilderness fresh with a bunch of other people in your anti-coup like militia, and you're like you're just one, like, ditch over from the National Guard who are doing their monthly training, and you're like. And then you run into them, and they're like, hey, what are you doing? You're like, I'm training to take out you if you become a problem.
Bad,
they're like,
I'm gonna fight
good luck with that.
They have all
See
these
later.
Guns. They have all these big rifles, and you have nothing. You're just, like, by yourself.
They're like, how are you going to do that? And they're like, nonviolently. You'll see.
I mean, there's a woman in Harvard who will show you. It's going to be a big deal.
So what is a mass – what would you do – to stop a coup? Is it, I guess, different depending on every coup, or
that's a really good point. It might be a little different for each one, but generally they follow one, like, they just do a few things, and you have to be creative, but you pretty much follow one principle, which is you withdraw cooperation with the government. So it feels like, to most people, this is kind of Gandhi's, like, key, like, insight. Mm-hmm. Which was, like, it seems to most people that the government rules over people because the government has power over you. But it turns out the actual fact, this is not, like, a metaphor or some kind of spiritual thing. This is, like, actual political philosophy fact, mm-hmm. is the government can only rule because of the consent of the ruled to be governed by the government. And so what you have to do is withdraw that consent very dramatically and very, like, rigidly and quickly. So that the message is sent to them, like, this will not go forward. Like, the society will grind to a halt if this coup happens, and therefore we demand for the actual government, the legal government, to be reinstated.
That's the meme is become ungovernable.
That's right. Now, that could be violence, though. So I don't want to promote exactly that phrase, because it could be like, oh, burn shit to the ground, you know, throw rocks at the police or something. You don't want to do that. Instead, you just want to withdraw all cooperation. So the key things are stop going to work, stop going to school, definitely stop paying taxes, block the street, just block the street with, get cars, take all the gas and wheels out of them and block the street, basically seize up everything so that nothing can happen in society. And if you do that, actually a very small number of people need to do that to have success. So Erica Chenoweth also researched this. So she researched for every nonviolent act, political change or political movement, mm-hmm. what percentage of people in the population needed to get involved. And she found this key number. She and her co-researcher found this key kind of golden number, which is 3.5%.
Huh.
Every single nonviolent battle like that was ever fought, if 3.5% of people got involved and withdrew their cooperation, they succeeded. There's never been a time in history when one did not succeed when it reached that threshold.
But you would want to have as much support as you could get, right? To have the validity or legitimacy. When you're describing this, I'm remembering a few years ago, there was a trucker-based shutdown of a city where they
in Canada.
Coordinated.
Or Florida or where?
I thought it was Canada or DC, but it was like they coordinated a, like just moving slowly on the streets and then parking and leaving big rigs in places that would just be really inconvenient. And you can't do anything about it. Cause it's like, what are you going to do? And just like this, it became characterized as like a siege on the city.
Right.
And it was not.
I think it was Canada.
It was Canada, right? But it was not.
Because they were mad at Trudeau. It was like a right wing thing, right?
It was.
Yeah.
But it's like that's kind of what you're describing in that there were no guns pulled out. It was strategic in the like impeding other people's convenience and stuff.
Yeah, great.
But I think the messaging was, hey, these are kind of like akin to terrorists, essentially. They're not using violence to accomplish their stuff.
Right.
But they're using inconvenience in somewhat the same way.
Very creative, very, very successful. Yeah, very good. I mean, I'm not saying their ends were good, but I'm saying tactically their means were very, I think, quite powerful.
Well, it definitely got them noticed and it got their platform widely spread very quickly because I heard about, I'm not in Canada. I've not been to Canada anytime recently. And I heard about this where I was from. It came to me. I didn't go to it.
Yeah. So, I'm not going to, I think I knew a little bit about what they were doing and I probably wouldn't be on their side in terms of what their ends were, but I certainly appreciate their means. I mean, far worse than that would be like violence, right? I mean, violence would create horrible chaos and obviously death and destruction and pain. And grief, here's what would happen if people actually took this idea up. It would be a bunch of sort of, leftist sort of Democrat, leftist activist type people would start, I imagine. And then they would be like, oh, well, so long as we're meeting, we should also protest all these things that are just our partisan things. And I would really think that's bad. I wouldn't want to do that. I would say if you really wanted to protect America and protect the government from a coup, You want to get together people who literally want to stop coups, and that's like their shared interest. And even if they have different beliefs about other issues, you could all agree that you want the Constitution to continue to be the kind of chief law of the government, and not some jerk or whatever of either stripe. Could take over. I'm afraid that it would probably get co-opted into like all this stuff. But or maybe that's another way to do it. You could say, hey, we're starting like a American Democracy Club where we're going to include anti-coup training and we're going to read the anti-coup or whatever. But we're also going to do pro-voting and pro-democracy stuff to support the Constitution, support democratic processes. I mean, that'd be cool too. But so long as people had that anti-coup
component
where they're getting trained in how to do an anti-coup.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the solution. That's
I've come up with a name for it.
Good. What is it?
Okay. It's called, hey, uncool. Dude,
I like that.
Uncool.
Uncool. dude.
Hey, uncool, because uncool, you're undoing a coup.
Okay, so this, you will not believe this, but Oot hit on the exact name of my club that I started. It was called Uncool.
That's so weird that nobody founder. Just rushed to join it with you. They weren't knocking on the table. Okay,
you want to hear how
stupid. Can I sign your...
Do you know how stupid the name was? It was called the Peace Query. I don't even know if it's English, but that's what it was called. It
the
was
Peace
like
Query?
Query, like the people who are going to ask questions about peace. It was so stupid. I had no shame and no self-awareness. I printed posters, put them all over joint. Come on Thursday at 5 p.m. in this meeting. No one came. Maybe one, like a friend came and was like, "Why?" You know, just to be a friendly. But then I was like, "Oh, no one wants to talk." Okay, nobody.
Did this group go on after this initial meeting, no, or did you?
No. Pack oh yeah, it yeah. Away? I kept trying to get it to start, and because I was just so taken with it. Because to me, it was like I had found like a cheat code in the universe. You know, like I was like, "Oh my god, this is crazy."
You're like, I could start a group and no one will hang out with me. How did I do that? Exactly. That's a cheat code.
Look at this cheat code. Well, I found a cheat code in like politics. Well, because we were reading, like I was studying like Machiavelli and we had just read like the Iliad and we were, you know, people would talk about, you know, the Iraq war was going on and everyone, the default thought was, man, violence is the ultimate arbiter of like things. That was what everyone was thinking. And then I was reading Gandhi like, no, dude, like this is a pretty strong evidence here. And then Chenoweth really goes to like way past where she really gathers the data and shows, you know, mm-hmm. the facts. So, I mean, but Gandhi just kind of intuited that, you know, and then he proved it. I mean, freed India from the British, you know, using that intuition. I mean, I'm sure I was really in people's face about it because I was a little bit obnoxious. I didn't have a nice podcast as an outlet, you know, where I kind of contained my ideas into just the podcast.
You had to go person to person and give each person the show every time.
Every time, right? And they were like, God,
this is so much more convenient.
Intolerable, yeah. That's right. This is the mass exploration of... I just think it would have been so cool if there had been a coup. I mean, obviously there wasn't, but even if there had been the threat of a coup, everyone was completely taken unawares after January 6th, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I was like flabbergasted. And everybody I talked to was the same way. They were just like, I cannot believe. First of all, I couldn't believe that just the police didn't like stop it. Like the police are so quick to just crush any protest I've ever seen has had massive police presence. And then all of a sudden, like 6,000 people can take over the central government's main building. I'm like, what the hell? I don't think people could get into a DMV in San Francisco with that. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, that was wild. I remember watching it as it was happening and thinking to myself, this is more shocking to me than 9/11 was, which I also was watching at the time, you know? And it's like, wow, I cannot believe this is happening. I have no idea. It's really a crazy terrifying situation.
Yeah.
And it kept going on for a very long time. You're like, somebody's going to swoop in and like do some massive action, right?
Yeah.
And
no. Yeah. Like show of force. I thought there was going to be like this show of force where like the trucks rolled in and was like, get the hell out of the Capitol. Right? We're arresting like 900 all of you.
tear gas.
That's what I thought was going to happen.
Dudes in masks slide in on like bungee cords. And
nope. They were just like, okay, well, if you're done now, please leave. Like, wander off.
Yeah, it was like very.
What the hell is going on?
It made you look at it and go like, oh, I don't know what I imagined would be the response to people invading the Capitol, but I thought it would be more than this.
I thought at least they would create like a cone around them outside the Capitol and surround into a perimeter and arrest every single person coming out. That's what I thought they were going
to
do.
But apparently, no, they had to track them down later and put up pictures on social media. Like, has anyone seen this person?
For no reason. I'm not trying to get them put them in jail.
Did they maybe not hang around you in your house during January 6th because they were possibly somewhere else? Give us a call. We're the 1-800-FBI-FBI-FBI or whatever.
Yeah, right. But wouldn't it have been cool? I thought, you know, as a member of the Peace Query, the sole member and president and treasurer of the Peace Query, I was thinking to myself, Well, first of all, I understood what was going on, or at least I understand how coups work. I mean, I lived through two coups when I lived in Thailand. Mm-hmm. So I know about coups. And so when it happened, I knew exactly like what the risks were and like how it could play out, at least a couple different scenarios. I didn't think very many of them were very likely because it looked like kind of a ragtag, you know, band or whatever. Mm. But I was at least thinking like that. But everyone else was just like flummoxed. Like, what would they do in a coup? They wouldn't, no one would know the first thing. And that's when I was like, oh, well, we all need to read Gene Sharp's Anti-Coup. Like, it's the playbook. Like, and it's stayed very recurrent and relevant. It's the playbook you can read to know exactly what to do during a coup. And so I just kept waiting, like, okay, pretty soon, like, this is going to be required reading in like high school civics classes, you know, like you're going to read To Kill a Mockingbird, and then you're going to read The Anti-Coup, you know, nope, no one's ever even. So I was like, okay, we got to use our huge platform. We got to use our giant, you know, our giant million subscriber TikTok, you know, man, and our likes. We get all these likes, we get all these clicks.
Is this Owen Wilson who's doing this?
Anyways, but yeah, so I thought we should use our platform to promote the anti-coup, and
yeah,
we should start little anti-coup militias, because then when there's the next coup, you know, people will say, what should we do? And we can literally call the newspapers and be like, we are the coup militias. We'll tell you what to do. Everyone stay home from work. Do not go to work on Monday. Do not go to school on Monday. Do not like do anything. Like, do not, if you work at the post office, do not show up. Like, do not do anything. And instead, like, go and park your car. Like, go buy a used car and park it in the middle of the road and rip it and like rip its wheels off and drain the gas out of it and like pull the alternator out and just abandon it and like screw up the street and do that at every single corner of every single street in your city, you know, to say, no, this government, this coup will not go forward. We are ungovernable, you know, with this coup. It's kind of fun, actually, you know, because you get to go basically just have a big party.
Sounds a little scary. It sounds like scary. Potentially, I mean, you're poking a bear.
Yeah, it's dangerous, but it's not, as long as you're not violent, you very rarely will see action against the people who are nonviolent. An example is Slobodan Milosevic, the Serbian dictator. Who was planning and maybe even executing like a genocide in Kosovo. And he was planning like Greater Serbia. He was trying to create Greater Serbia. Uh-huh. And then there was a mass nonviolent opposition to him. And the order came down from, you know, his generals or from him to the police, like to the soldiers who were like facing the nonviolent protesters. Mm-hmm. And they said, shoot on the protesters. And when the order came to shoot on the protesters, the army switched sides to the nonviolent side, and Slobodan Milosevic was taken out. Well, not killed, but he was just arrested.
So, wait a minute.
And that was an example of where if they had used violence and then they said shoot on the people, they would have been like, sure, I'm scared as shit, and these guys are using violence. Let's shoot them, and they'll get out of here. We'll kill, you know, a couple hundred of them, and they'll run off, and the protests will be over. But because they kept nonviolent discipline, when the order came to shoot, they were like, that's beyond,
but wait, it sounds like in this circumstance, the nonviolence made a coup happen instead of stopping a coup.
No, because the reason why they were protesting was because he was seizing power and executing it. He had seized non-constitutional power and was executing a Holocaust. Like, but he was murdering.
Isn't a coup people. Just cutting the head off of like whoever the top person is, just getting ousting them?
Yeah, but it's really ousting the Constitution. It's like a constitutional crisis, really. Any kind of constitutional crisis is essentially a coup. Although you're right, a coup d'etat is when you like replace the executive, you replace the government.
A coup is a regular, but upending the way things were and having a new order. Yeah,
any kind of like even when Xi just like changed the constitution of China so that he's like the permanent guy, like the Chinese could have done an anti-coup then too, same thing, because he was changing the constitution, causing a constitutional crisis. So yeah, coup clubs, it would be a good thing, the coup militias, you know. And if people ever said, no, you can't have that militia, you'd be like, Second Amendment, bro, right to form a militia. Or at least the founding fathers telling us that the important thing for preserving freedom is not so much guns as much as militias.
Well, and yeah. And the ones, the people who say you can't have that militia, they're worried about the guns, not the people who are planning nonviolent action. So really? I don't know I that you'll right. be opposed. You're right. Like, you're not going to be the target of a lot of like people coming after you, trying to get you to stop all your nonviolencing.
Stop the militias. That's true. They probably would rather have the nonviolence than the violence.
You know, I was thinking one of the clever things about making a group in college where you're the only member. Coups are impossible. It's absolutely impossible for a coup to happen.
I'm the judge, jury, and executioner.
Yeah, you were coup-proof. There was no one who was going to swoop up and like make you not top dog. That's pretty smart.
You know what they call a coup when you add two more doors?
Oh, no.
A sedan.
Oh, no. Oh, is that it? Did we just end the episode? I mean, I can't imagine anyone still listening after that. I mean, we should probably leave too,
it's
right?
Over,
we just emptied
mic
the
drop,
listener base.
Mic drop. Yeah. Yeah, let's wrap.
Well, right on.
All right.
An anti-coup. I'll join an anti-coup militia.
Let's start with just this. We can be an honorary anti-coup militia here.
We already have double the membership of the peace queries.
Oh, easily double. Scott, thank you so much for listening and for everyone else for listening to the
Thanks
crazy
for tuning
idea.
In. And we'll see you again next week.
Yeah. See ya.
Bye.